You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast. This is the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 47 for February 2017. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. I encourage you to visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to the stories we discussed in today's show, including links to our special guest. We are also part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. Thanks to everyone for their comments, follows, likes on Facebook, Twitter, and emails. And a very special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. We have a new one this month, by the way. Ring the bell, Morgan. You're no help, Morgan. Ding, ding, ring the bell. Come on. We have a new Patreon subscriber, Stephen Williams. Thank you, Stephen, for being our latest Patreon subscriber. You can tell we don't rehearse the show, ladies and gentlemen, because Morgan didn't ring the bell when he was supposed to for the new Patreon subscriber. go out to patreon.com/centersteer for all the details and to make your monthly contribution to help out the show. I'm your host, John Costage, here in wonderful Western Pennsylvania. It is the evening of February 28th, the last day of February. We have this wonderful winter here in our neck of the woods, which is either cold or extremely hot, at least for this time of year. I have had very little snow. Right now, I think it's 50 degrees or something. Tomorrow's supposed to go 60, and then by the weekend, it'll get down to the 30s again. It's bizarre.
Last Friday it was 80. Saturday night it was 30.
I turned the furnace off for like 4 days. It was like absolutely no reason.
I spent days shoveling snow a couple of weeks ago, and it's, you know, this weekend I spent a whole bunch of time outside doing yard work.
Yeah,
it's kind of nice, but it's interesting.
It's confusing.
One day it was working last week and I heard a motor and I thought, if someone's cutting their grass, I'm going to go out there. Thankfully, it was a guy chipping wood. So
nice. Well, my Siberian Husky already shed out all of her winter coat.
And that is our contributor from the Green Mountain State in Vermont.
Hey, I'm Morgan.
There you go. Welcome, Morgan. Thanks for joining us for the show and giving us your snow update. We appreciate that. How's the discos?
The disco is still parked in the driveway with a leaking head gasket and or a slipped sleeve. It'll be interesting to tear into it and figure out which or both it is.
Well, you've had good weather. You should be out there.
I know. That was kind of unexpected.
I understand. So you're driving the Volvo still?
I am, yeah.
Gotcha. And also joining me from Western Pennsylvania is my esteemed colleague and friend.
Depending on the day, yes. I'm Harold.
And that's Harold. Welcome, Harold. He's joining us via Skype today because he's deeply involved in getting my Defender ready and prepared for paint. So
I'm busy doing important things.
Oh, come on. You got to follow that up with important people. Come on.
Well, you know, you already said it was for you, so.
There we go. Our guest this month is John Blashford Snell. He is of the Scientific Exploration Society. We previously recorded that interview with John. He back in, I think, February 15th, if I'm not mistaken. He is a great storyteller. The reason I got him on the show is I met him at the Overland Expo East. He was the gentleman, he's a Royal Engineer with the British Army, and he is the gentleman who led the expedition that took the first motorized vehicles through the Darien Gap. And the Darien Gap is between North and South America. That road, by the way, is still not complete, but he was the first one. They took two Range Rovers. That was in 1972. If I remember correctly, and they took two Range Rovers through. So he tells a story around a number of stories around that, and it's also he also has a book and a website, and I have all those links in the show notes, of course, for it. But that's our interview this month, and I'll be coming up later in the show. And also an update on a few folks that are part of the show. Dave Carroll, he's home now, and he's has some additional chemo to follow in the next couple months. So good for Dave. He's back home and hopefully he'll get better, continue to get better. Apparently
the numbers on his blood work are looking really good, so he's making good progress.
Indeed he is.
That is really great to hear.
Indeed. Indeed he is. Yes, good. And the Bells, Graham, Louisa, and the kids have departed the Americas for Europe. Their 130 has been remodeled, and I believe it's being shipped. I didn't see any mention about it, the vehicle being shipped, but I know they had gotten on their flight, I think, yesterday or today, this morning. Actually, today. I believe they're on their way to Europe.
Yeah. Elvis has left the continent.
And we wish them well on their new five-year mission. Because wasn't it like 5 years to the day they were in the Americas? I think that's what they said.
Something like that, yeah.
It was something like that, yeah.
So there we go, their new five-year mission.
I like how you worked that in there.
Thank you. See, there was a little bit of planning for the show today, just a little.
Got to make a nerd reference in there somewhere.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because at the end of the day, I am a geek.
And the beginning, too. But anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Let's get into the news. First up is legendary PR man who put Land Rover on the map in the United States. Bill Baker has passed away at 72 years old. This happened a couple days ago this month in February. Just to read you a little bit in the article that I saw about the gentleman. I personally didn't know about it, but apparently he was very influential in putting Land Rover in the position that it is here, not only in America, but I think by extension through the rest of the world. So he was, as I said, 72. His career took him through many other car companies, including Ford, Volvo, Fiat, Lancia, Ferrari. He worked for Sony, and I believe also Chrysler. He worked for them before he was one of the first employees of Land Rover of North America in 1986. That's when Land Rover was coming back into the United States with the Range Rover.
The second coming.
Yes. I think he was a Land Rover nut even at that time. But the Land Rover brand ignited in Baker a spark of creativity and passion that cemented his reputation as one of the most brilliant and strategic public relations executives in the industry. The Auto Week article here talks about. And some of the things that he did, which were influential, they think that Range Rover got traction in part because of the company's catchy ads by Grace and Rothschild, which showed the off-road vehicle in places such as luxurious Long Island homes, but also covered with mud, a first in the automotive advertising, and the creative way Baker promoted the brand and the vehicles to the media.
Doing what Land Rover should.
Yeah, and those
be muddy and still be present.
And I still love some of those, especially the Range Rover ones from that era where they really did mix that impression of luxury yet complete capability.
Mud as a fashion accessory.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you could put them up on your wall as art, really. And I'm sure many people do. I mean, they are that good of an ad. He also dreamed up and hosted extreme driving expeditions in North America, South America, and Africa that got influential auto riders behind the wheel of Land Rover's rugged vehicles in extremely hostile terrain. And there were specific places he wanted to go. They told me, I thought they had that in here. He went, oh, here we go. Bill Baker single-handedly put Land Rover on the map at a time when there was virtually no product. His press trips spanned the globe, each a once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Great Divide, Morocco, Scotland, Iceland, Belize, and on and on. A Land Rover would certainly not be the unquestionably authentic brand in the U.S. market were it not for Bill and Charlie Hughes building the stories, painting the picture, and making it thoroughly first person for so many writers and journalists. His legacy will endure. And that was a former colleague of his, Jim Resnick, said. Hughes said that Bill was critical to our success. Arguably, he was the most creative PR person of his time. So if it wasn't for Bill Baker, probably might even have this podcast, actually, come to think of it, because he kept the brand here in the U.S. going.
Very true. The mention that he did some stuff for Volvo makes me wonder whether he did those turbo Volvo wagon ads that had them sort of standing off against Lamborghinis.
Very possible. Very possible.
That's kind of a wild concept when you think about it.
Really?
Everybody, doff your cap and a drink to Mr. Baker for his contribution to Land Rover. And thank you, sir. And rest in peace. Why don't we move on to other news in the Land Rover world? Tata post 96% profit plunge as Land Rover sales decline. This article is out of Mumbai, so I have to say the English is not always as clear as I wish it could be. But the thing that struck me from this article was that how much Land Rover contributes to Tata's profit, and profit was way down for now. This admittedly, the headline makes it sound really bad, and it is. I mean, 96% falls bad, but it was net profit for the third quarter. So, and it's just it's one data point, not necessarily a trend yet. But they had sharply lower earnings for JLR, and they also had losses in their domestic business. You know, Tata's a big, they have an IT company. I think they produce other household goods, if I'm not mistaken, in India. So, JLR is part of it, but it's interesting to see how much they are part of the profit for Tata.
Tata also owns a very large steel business in India. I think it's the largest. In fact, they have a company town. It's basically the Pittsburgh of India.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing wrong with that, mind you. But I'm just saying they have a lot of domestic businesses. So it's unclear in that article how much of that plunge in profit is from the domestic business and how much is from JLR. But it definitely sounds like, you know, they rely on JLR for their profits.
Yeah, indeed. And Land Rover sales in the U.S. JLR sales in the U.S. is 25% of JLR's overall sales. So that's a significant portion, which leads us into another article. Been a change of administration here in the U.S., and one of the things that they've talked about is an import.
Really?
There's been an import duty on products coming into the U.S., estimated, I've heard here, of like maybe 20% company. I don't know if they're advertising or not, but they ran the numbers and they believe that that an import tax would hit JLR hardest at something like $17,000 a vehicle, while Ford would get hit with just maybe $300 a vehicle.
Well, and the reason for that is they actually ranked all the vehicle manufacturers they studied based on the percentage of domestic content. And Land Rover has 0% North American content, whereas Ford has, I think, 82%, I think was the number I saw. And that's why they would have the least impact.
Right. Yeah, I know. Yeah, BMW several years ago, I mean, they have a plant in South Carolina. I think Volvo has a South Carolina plant coming online soon. And didn't Land Rover, when they were thinking about opening plant in the Americas, both North and South, they looked at the U.S. and I think end up in Brazil, though, did they not? So I'm wondering.
The curious thing with this is that, you know, one of the things this article talked about is this may spur some of those manufacturers to step up their North American operations to try and cut down the duty. Wouldn't it be cool if Land Rover decided to start building in this country?
It'd be very cool.
Yeah. I mean, if it's going to save them $17,000 per truck, maybe it makes sense.
Yeah, but it's not going to necessarily save the American consumer $17,000. It's just,
saying, with that much of a duty, it starts. Yeah. There might be some economic case for it.
Sure, but I think a lot
certainly would mean that there's not going to be a $17,000 per vehicle increase for the consumer if they end up having to set up a plant in the U.S.
Yeah, but the cost of operating, the cost of building a plant, the time it takes to build a plant, get it up and running, get it staffed, get the right tooling in place, what would you build? Would you build the incomplete vehicle? Would you just build engines? Would you just build bodies or frames? And if you do that, then you still have to source parts to complete the vehicle like other manufacturers do. I think they would, and then there's the factor of how long do you think this would last? Would this only last for 4 years of this administration, in which case do you wait it out? Or do you think that maybe this would be a long-term thing and would not go away, in which case, well, then investing that money to build a plant, and would you build a complete plant? So there's a
whole lot of what-ifs.
A lot of ifs. I think the important thing is how this would directly affect us. I mean, if you're spending $90,000 on a Range Rover, another $17,000 is probably not going to bother you too much if they do pass all that cost on. But if you're bringing a new vehicle into the U.S. that people want and crave, and it's going to go up by, and then the base price is going to be probably, what, $40,000, and then the tax kicks onto that, and that's going to be another $10,000,
right.
That directly affects the introduction of the new Defender to the U.S., and the U.S. is critical critical to the strategy for the new Defender. That's one of the reasons why they stopped building how they did, because they wanted to redesign it completely to meet the American market. I think they're shaking in their boots whether this happens or not.
They should be.
Yeah.
They should be very concerned.
I mean,
it is only 4 years that this hits them, I mean, that could make or break the U.S. market for Land Rover.
I think
$17,000, it may be, you know, proportionally a smaller amount of the amount you would pay for a vehicle, but you're going to expect to have a $17,000 better vehicle for that price.
Right. I don't think the consumers are so desperate to have Land Rovers and Range Rovers that they're willing to pay that price increase without getting some sort of added benefit.
Yeah, I think this is very concerning, and I'm sure it's distressful to all of JLR. Actually, to come to think of it, even the Jaguar side, they're starting to rebound a little bit. And if you tag on another $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 onto a Jaguar,
that's going to hurt them.
Yeah, or even if you pause or hold off, maybe they end up delaying the new Defender and try to wait out that part of it, which they could probably get away with. The current vehicles that are already inbound, you know, the new Disco Sport, the new Disco itself, the D5, that could certainly impact them and their pricing, which directly impacts the company. You look at how small Land Rover is. Comparison to other car companies in the U.S., you know, they have, 1% of the market? And if they're going to get hit super hard or the worst with an import duty.
Yeah, that really, really could almost kill off their U.S. market.
And potentially could severely impact the company, potentially even. I mean, I guess you could extend it. It might kill off the company, too. I mean, I think it'd be unlikely, but it's certainly a possibility. I mean,
that's a bit of a reach, but I mean, it could happen, but yeah, I mean, it definitely would have an impact. Whether how right. severe the impact is, we'll see.
Exactly. I guess one reason maybe why I just thought of this, why it could severely impact or kill off the company would be if the U.S. ends up starting some sort of trade war or import duty war, where other countries then say, "Well, you're putting up 20, we're putting up 20," and then all of a sudden, you know, China does it, and maybe the U.K. or Europe and whatnot, and then for Land Rover, because they're importing a lot of their stuff into China. Although I think they have a China plant coming online, that could severely impact them. So,
Yeah. Okay. And when is this supposed to go into effect?
It's not. It's just proposed. It's discussed. That was one of the things the administration, when it came in, said they wanted to see an import duty, and that was on products. Period. That were not made in America, and that was one of the way. And that was a proposal for how if a wall were built, that's how it would be paid for. So this was, and it was not. So it's just a proposal. I don't even know if it's a proposal. It's just a thought that went out. Yeah. And how we're reading the tea leaves currently, the current administration. Right. So yeah.
Now on the other side of the coin, just to look at it another way. This really only affects new vehicles, or I guess technically if you're going to bring in a 25-year-old one, it could affect you there too. But that actually kind of helps the old car hobby, if you will, because the new ones become so expensive, there's more interest in keeping the old ones going.
Right. That's a good point.
Very true.
Although it would.
I've seen that in a lot of countries that have enacted high import duties. The cars are so expensive to buy that people spend the money and the time to keep the old ones going.
Cuba, like Cuba did, effectively.
Yeah, I was thinking
that
Greece,
was for other reasons.
But yeah.
No, they're all very similar. The question I would have, to extend your thought, Harold, is would it just be on, say, finished products, or would this also affect parts? So if, I needed new doors for my Defender 110, would there be a 20% duty on those?
Conceivably, yes.
Right, exactly. That would, unknown, of course, because, that's just a thought more than even a proposal, so there's no a lot of detail to go off of.
Mind you, a lot of auto parts already have a 25% duty.
How's that?
I don't remember. Well, I just know if you go down through. I mean, the customs, the duty schedules are very, very complex and hard to read, and it's a challenge when you're importing certain components to figure out where they fit. some things are duty free, some things are 2.5%, and yeah, literally some things, I think bumpers might even be 25%. You know, it's just weird. Every part has a classification that is listed in the customs duty schedule, and because of treaties and negotiations and all kinds of weird things that have happened in the past, the parts are all at different rates.
All right, well, we'll continue to monitor that as, of course, we're based here in the U.S., and Land Rover fans, kind of close to our heart, plus new Defender coming online. I think that's critical to the success of that.
Yeah, very much.
All right, so moving on in the news, I'm calling these quick hits, just some little interesting things that Land Rover related. First up, $3.7 million in engines were stolen from the factory in 6 minutes.
Yeah, gone in 360 seconds.
I had to laugh. Yep. I just
twice.
And you're, and that was it. Yeah, criminals came in, 6 minute heist on a Tuesday night in Birmingham, and they brought in their truck. I didn't say what kind of truck, by the way, whether it was a Land Rover or something else, but they connected their truck to a trailer that was holding the engines and drove out. And they
I'm thinking it had to have been a lorry of some sort, because I think it was like a semi-trailer type thing.
Okay. Oh, you mean like a big rig kind of for us. Yeah, gotcha.
I think somebody had to have been giving them information from the inside to tell them that there was going to be a trailer and where it was going to be, because somebody just drove in, hooked up, and pulled out just like they were taking a load, just, and it looked very natural.
Yeah, I think they said they forged some paperwork to get through the gate, and so nobody really suspected anything.
Did I not see an article? And I thought I saw that they caught these people, or they got the engines back. I should have done a little more research. It just dawned on me. I see that in passing somewhere that they caught up these. Maybe Morgan, you can do a little check while we're moving on.
Well, the real question then is once they did get them back, are they still going to use them? A lot of times, once things are out of their control, they crush them just because they don't want the hassle.
Sure, that makes sense. Another interesting quick hit story, JLR to recall 6,500 vehicles in China because defective safety belts. So that's they're being recalled there if you have a JLR and you're in China. JLR calls for global media agency review. Tata-owned JLR is going to look at all their media agencies worldwide. They currently have Mindshare, and they've been the media agency in record since 2000 when Ford owned them. So they're looking at a new ad agencies around the globe. I'm a little concerned because I've liked their media, and I think they do a really good job in the PR and the media area, and I hope this doesn't negatively affect that in the coming years.
Yeah, I hope not. I hope it's more just to deal with, modern marketing types and methods. So,
or maybe it's just to coordinate communication amongst their brands and to get more cohesive with their media.
Or right. Maybe the company that the Mindshare folks maybe wanted to up the contract too much, and this is an opportunity to say, hey, you're asking for too much money.
Right. It could be a cost containment thing. I really don't care how they do it or what they do, as long as the quality of the communications doesn't change.
Just briefly back to the engine.
Oh, just an update. We have an update. This just in.
Yep.
The podcast
just in,
is
a new update.
apparently three men were arrested on suspicion of conspiracy to steal. So some people have been arrested for that.
Does it say
conspiracy? That does sound like it was planned, probably from the inside.
They at least had one person.
Or
somebody had to be helping them.
Yep.
Allegedly, we don't have all the facts. Moving on, the Range Rover Reborn program has kicked off. This is similar to what they did for the Series 1 trucks, where they're going to do some restoration treatment of your Range Rover if you are so inclined. So that program has kicked off.
So just like our Heritage segments, they finished with the Series. Now they're on to the Range Rover Classic.
Exactly. Well, they only did the Series 1, admittedly.
True, but they're still actually doing restorations of all sorts of other Series vehicles. It's just that this is the first Range Rover that they've done. And obviously, it's just really nice to see a 1970 Range Rover in pristine condition roll off their line.
Three-door, by the way.
Well, they were all three-door at that time.
Yes, they were. You would know that if you listened to the Center Steer Heritage segment about Range Rovers. Moving on in Range Rover news, because it seems like the rest of this is going to be almost all Range Rover news. The Range Rover Velar is being introduced. By the time you hear this podcast, it should already have been debuted. It's supposed to debut on March 1. In fact, actually, it's probably just a couple hours away, because isn't it? What is it, midnight?
It is now actually March 1 in the UK.
Yes, and it's
1 minute after midnight.
And the world premiere is March 1. U.S. debut is at the New York Auto Show. So this will be a new Range Rover vehicle slotted between the Range Rover Sport and the Range Rover Evoque.
Oh, to fill in that white space that Jerry was talking about.
Indeed, indeed. Where does that name come from, Morgan?
So that actually is a code name that a fake company name that they registered and plastered on their original test vehicles for the Range Rover to prevent, any association with Land Rover. Because it was an entirely new vehicle, so it's not like they drove it down the street and people were like, hey, look, a new Land Rover, a new Range Rover. Very interesting that they're hearkening back to that.
So sort of like corporate development camo.
Yes, definitely. And in fact, Velar just means to like veil or hide something.
Okay.
So it's the Range Rover hidden. Now, here's my question. Will there be a sport model? Will there be a Range Rover Velar Sport? I kid. That's Land Rover humor.
I'm still processing the irony of this being named for something that's been concealed and veiled, and they're having the unveiling of it tomorrow.
The unveiling of the hidden, yes. Of the
yeah.
unveiling the veiled.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether it's going to be sort of like the Discovery prototype that was called something else.
Oh, that was just the DX or something, wasn't it?
I can't remember off the top of my head. I thought it was a Discovery something.
Concept. Wasn't it like the Discovery concept?
But this is
a full-on production.
Of course, had a different name, too.
That's true.
Yeah, this is a full-on production vehicle. Speaking of the Evoque, they are starting to... they have a test mule of the Evoque 2. So that is... it doesn't look any different, although it's tough to tell in the pictures, because it's partially obscured with Harold's favorite urban camo. But the interesting part about this, at least I think for us in the podcast, is there's a high voltage sticker on the back of the vehicle. So the thought is it's either, is it full hybrid or is it a full electric vehicle or is it a hybrid? And the suspicion is it's a diesel electric hybrid vehicle.
I would absolutely drive an Evoque if it was full electric or hybrid.
I think a full electric Evoque would be kind of killer. I think it would hit the right market of people and satisfy the folks that want that, and probably the right range and the ability to carry a little bit of stuff. But and get
I'm not ready for full electric. But I want a diesel hybrid. That's just what I need.
Yeah, yeah.
Agreed. But I'd like a diesel hybrid in something bigger like the Sport. Or sorry, not the Sport. The Sport would be fine, but in the full Disco 5.
Speaking of the Disco 5, in the U.S., they did the Road Show, which is a CNET publication. They took a spin in the Disco TD6 diesel, and they really, 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 really liked it, which is nice to know. It's big, massive on the inside, 2,500 liters of space in the back to play with when you put the seats down. There are family-friendly cubby holes. You can put your phone, your wallet, your headphones, your passport, your water bottle in the refrigerator. There's even space for four full-size iPads and a center console. And you can charge anything you want because it has eight USB points throughout the vehicle to charge, in addition to all the other normal gizmos of the terrain response and the seats that fold down automatically and the tail boot that opens up with the wave of your foot, which is probably an optional extra, no doubt. The thing that we liked is it had the diesel in it. A 3-liter V6 diesel, 256 horses, 443 pound-feet of torque, 0 to 62 in 7.7 seconds, and 32.6 miles per gallon.
Nice. That's actually, yeah, that's pretty impressive for the 0 to 60 for that size vehicle in the diesel, too.
It's impressive all around. I mean, I get.
I'm not surprised. I mean, acceleration is based on torque, and the diesel has the torque.
Yeah,
that's true.
You know, the Jetta gets just around the town. I get probably 32 or so, and then on the highway, I can get pushing up to 47, 48 miles per gallon. So, if I'm assuming that's around the town number, 32.6. Even if that's high, which it probably is, that's great.
Yeah, I would actually say most of the, at least the new mileage specs for the U.S. are actually easier to beat than the old ones used to be.
Hmm. Well, that's certainly true with a diesel, and that's just part and parcel with the EPA test cycles evolve, of course, but it just seems like it, the way it's been for quite some time, you know, the gasoline estimate, you know, if you're careful driving, you can beat it. The diesel numbers on the stickers, unless you're driving like an idiot, it's hard not to beat those numbers.
So that if you get yourself a $50,000 Disco 5 with a TD6, give us a call. Hey, we'd love to.
Oh, yeah. I want to play with it, so let me know.
Exactly. We'll get you on the show.
Yeah, we're now accepting donations. So.
Yes, go to our Patreon account.
I'll throw this out there then. If you buy yourself a TDV6 anything, be it Disco 5 or anything else they may choose to put it in, if you bring it to my shop, I will give you a free inspection. I will check it out thoroughly and not charge you.
And I assume that requires you to go behind the wheel, and the car will be gone for, what, approximately 2 hours?
Absolutely. Extended test drive is an important part of the inspection process.
Of course, because you're going to call me. We'll have to go out to lunch. So.
Now, we may even test its mud retention abilities.
And if you really want, you can offer the free infinite test point inspection. You'll just continually test it for them.
And for as long as you have questions, I will continue to check it out.
And you may even have to take a long-term test drive to Vermont.
Okay.
By all means.
Because you got to get that long-term test driving. Yeah.
I have no problem with that.
Land Rover related, but not. We've talked about this before. There's a new Ford Bronco coming. And I just saw an article in the last couple of weeks that just kind of reinforced our thinking that the Ford Bronco is becoming like a Defender here in the U.S. especially, just that it's they're becoming sought after, in demand. There's a kind of a vintage SUV crowd, market burgeoning. And so it seems like the original Ford Bronco 1 is moving into that kind of Defender area where it's sought after, and it's the prices that looks like it's probably the entry point anyways, maybe not there where Defenders are of holding, you know, commanding a high price and holding, but Broncos are on their way there.
They're certainly collectible. Yeah.
And there's a new Bronco proposed for the same time, as we've talked about before, as the new Defender coming out.
Right, a premium heritage utility vehicle, basically.
And I believe, if I remember correctly, that this Bronco is still going to have solid axles, which I believe is going to, well, we'll have to see what the Defender ends up having. But it may actually leave the Defender and the Bronco as the only remaining SUVs with solid axles. Because I believe the Jeep is moving away from those.
I don't think the Defender is going to have solid axles.
I don't think it will either. I think the Bronco may be standing alone on that deal.
Speaking of the Defender, there's a chemical company in the UK. You've probably seen these articles, just at least touch on it, that is thinking about, what's their name? I finally found their name. Enos Group Holdings, a chemical company based in Rolle, Switzerland. They are said to be looking at possibly maybe the idea, should they bring the Defender back and produce it.
Yeah, I don't know that they'll be able to get away with that, but they may be able to do their own vehicle, which, you know, emulates, you know, do a tribute Defender, but they can't call it the Defender, and they can't, of course, build it exactly to spec.
Yeah, I think originally they wanted to call it the Defender and build it to spec, and I think this generation they're saying is going to be inspired by the Defender, but be its own vehicle in a similar vein.
I'm certain that JLR will not let them do that, so that it'll have to be a tribute at best.
Exactly. Now, it'll be interesting to see, because obviously, basically, Land Rover themselves, but all other manufacturers have had to discontinue vehicles that are that similar to the Defender, just because of new regulations. So it would be interesting to see how close they can even get it.
Well, I think your point there is that they definitely wouldn't come to the U.S. then. It might be able to hang out in the in Europe and certainly in Asia, but I think definitely it wouldn't be able to.
No, I don't think they could sell enough of them to justify the certification process.
Moving on specifically to the Land Rover Defender replacement, last week in an article out of Australia, Drive, which is the name of the drive.com.au, and that's a Australia publication. They talked to our friend of the show, Jerry McGovern. I'm calling him friend of the show. Maybe he'll come on the show someday.
Wow, you're being generous.
Jerry's important. He, as you know, he's the Land Rover design chief, and he's responsible for all the Land Rover designs of the last several years, from the Evoque on. So let's read this article and talk about it. It's not too long, but I think there's a lot of parsing of language here and ideas and thoughts that we can discuss about it, because near and dear to our hearts, the Defender. So Land Rover's much-missed Defender is coming along, and sometime soon. The new Discovery, more upmarket, means the brand will have more scope to appeal to a market that wants a proper, hard-as-nails SUV, according to the company's design boss, Jerry McGovern. So after initially scolding Australian journalists for constantly bothering him with questions about when Defender will be replaced, a reflection of the interest in the legendary off-road in our local market, McGovern seemed pleased to announce that Defender is coming. Referring to the polarizing concepts the company has been rolling out for the past 5 years at motor shows for a new Defender, McGovern said, we should all ignore them, and expect a new SUV with a more appealing design, not too far removed from Evoque and the new Discovery. Quote, I'll tell you one thing about that Defender. It's going to be nothing like those bloomin' concept cars we showed a few years ago, because we took the mick with those, unquote, he jested. Quote, our brand has been a journey of transformation, and the Discovery is the latest on that step. It's less polarizing, more appealing. We haven't always been known for great design in the past because we came from a very functional base. The cars look like they did, so they could do what they had to do, but that's what I want us to be known for, design. You'll see that on the Defender. It is coming. We've pushed Discovery closer to Range Rover, which will allow the Defenders to come in under that. Unquote. Almost done. McGovern says the brand will be split into three peers. We've heard that before, with Range Rover representing the It's Me exclusivity, Discovery being about versatility and lifestyle enabling, while Defenders are going to be all about their durability. The end goal is to have a much bigger family of Land Rovers available, allowing the company to build volume and tap into the huge growth in demand for SUVs, which is well placed to capitalize on. Excuse me. Final quote. The Defenders, when they come, there will be a whole family of them. And if you look at where they currently are and where we could be in 6 or 7 years, it's a massive shift, unquote, McGovern said.
Can I go yet?
By all means. The road is yours. Take the wheel.
Just, I am getting so tired of him saying the word appealing. You know, what did he say it three times in that quote you gave? You know, the Discovery is more appealing. Well, in your opinion, Jerry, maybe it's more appealing, but maybe we don't agree with you. And, you know, the new Defender is going to be appealing in your mind, Jerry. But is it going to be appealing? Are we going to like it? Just because you say we are doesn't mean we are, Jerry.
And if it looks very similar to the Discovery and the Range Rover, I think he's going to get the mick again.
I don't consider that appealing. And I think it contradicts because, well, Jerry's about the contradiction, as we know. Every time he opens his mouth, he ends up contradicting himself. He starts off by saying a tough-as-nails SUV, and then he talks about it being appealing like the Discovery.
All for tough-as-nails, but...
Yeah, and I don't think that's going to make it look tough-as-nails.
No.
Well, and he also mentioned this that when he was talking about the three families are going to have, and he says Defenders are going to be all about their durability. I don't think.
Well, then that's great if that happens.
I think you should use the word capability, I think durability is the wrong word there. I think capability, maybe it's a British thing, but for me, the word should be capable. That's what I think about when I think about the Defender and even the series trucks. It was capable of doing things.
Except that
durability implies your stuff doesn't break, which, I mean, all of it should be durable.
Right.
But maybe he's using durable in the place of rugged or something like that, which, I mean, the Defender should be a rugged-looking vehicle and ruggedly capable.
Right. And I think the other part of it is that all of the Land Rovers really – Land Rovers and Range Rovers at this point are very capable. Even since, like, the Disco 2 – the Discovery has been more capable than the Defender in many, many aspects. So I don't think that they're necessarily going to make something that's immensely more capable than, like, the Discovery line.
Well, not considering they're going to probably have the same mechanicals.
How could you? Really? With the computers and the electronic abilities that they have now, in many ways they are more capable than anything that's ever been in the past. I don't know how you can make it even more capable. Maybe there's a reason.
They're more capable than in the past, but yet at the same time more fragile.
Right.
Admittedly. Yes.
And so maybe that's where they're going to go for simplicity, to try to gain some of that durability. One would hope. Yeah.
I mean, that's what I would want. That's what, and if they let me make the decisions, that's what I would do. But as we might surmise, I don't agree with Jerry's opinions on stuff very often. So we'll see.
It'll be interesting.
I tend to think the durability capability discussion. I think the vehicle, the underpinnings will be not like anything that a Defender has ever seen. I suspect it'll be closer to a Disco. Maybe a Range Rover.
I think it's the corporate platform now, pretty much.
I think it's the way they build cars, and Jerry's all about the style. He said it. He's not about necessarily function. And I think I would suspect this is my guess on my part, of course, but that he sees that the other vehicles are capable, they're functional, they do what they need to do, and it's just you reskin it. And I think you're going to see a same underpinnings that you currently have in the other rest of the line with a different skin, and then he'll slap the Defender name on it.
Yeah, I think it's just gonna. Yeah, and the thing is that Jerry, he thinks it's something completely new and distinctive when he just like takes a pinch and a tuck out of what he already has.
That's true.
Yeah,
I mean, the Discos look like the Range Rovers, so it's not much of a stretch to think that he's going to make the Defenders look like the Discos. And somehow still say they're distinctive.
I agree. Hopefully they're also, we already know that they're sort of fitting them in at the bottom of the pyramid, right? In terms of price, at least.
Well, that's the way it should be.
And I think that's where they're going, because they've sort of moved the Discovery line up a little closer to the Range Rover line. So hopefully they'll take out some of the stuff that makes it electronically more fragile. But we'll see. Probably not enough.
Doubt it. I think you're going to see it slotted between a Disco and a Disco Sport. Disco Sport is going to be your entry-level vehicle. Then you'll see, I think, the main Defender, of which there's going to be a family of them, of course, they tell us. But I think that main Defender will go in between the Sport and the Disco.
That's not breaking new ground, because there's always been a family of Defenders. There's been a 90, a 110, and a 130.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully they'll still have the 90 and the 110 and the 130.
God, I hope so.
I
do not want to see everything be 100 inch. It's like, at that point, what's the point?
Right. Yeah.
Make a short one, make a long one, make them different lengths than the Disco. Just otherwise, it's just another Disco. What's the point?
And it'll be interesting to see if they have any, pickup truck bodies or anything like that.
Absolutely.
And that's our new Defender rant for the month.
That was a short one.
I know. Well, we covered a lot of ground last month, admittedly. That was a tour de force last
never
month.
Stopped us before from continuing to rant.
and we can
do an additional extra podcast every month.
I actually have an idea, and I think I'll leave this in the show because I have this idea and see what our listeners think. What if we had a special, strictly Defender roundtable discussion? And come up with something, some sort of moderator-led thing. But I would think, and I want to get people that maybe listen to the show around the world, different places, maybe get 4, 5, 6, 8 of us, and we take an hour or two and then talk about it. You know, what do we think it should be like? You know, what should it have? What shouldn't it have? You know, those kinds of things.
And that sounds good. Or we could have our listeners tweet in what they think, and we could read them.
That we could do maybe do some sort of live thing. Well, think about it. So if you have an idea, listeners, for what do you, or if you even just like the idea of some sort of special, I think I could see it as a special podcast edition, just talking about what we think about the things we know about the new Defender, things we know about the new Defender, and things that maybe we want to see, and maybe some projections or predictions. There we go. And that's the news for the month of February 2017. Next up on the Center Steer podcast is our interview with Colonel John Blashford Snell. We called him on February 15th via Skype to the UK. Well, John's audio sounded really good, and we didn't have any problems with that. There seemed to be some echo as a result of the Skype call to him. So if you hear any echoing when we ask our questions, my apologies for that. John talked most of the time, didn't really need our input, so I don't think it affects the overall interview at all. So now sit back and enjoy our interview with Colonel John Blashford Snell.
Hello.
Hello, John.
Hello, John.
What the hell?
How are you, sir?
Yeah.
That's good.
That's good.
I'm sorry I had to rush last night, but I had a dinner to go to.
No, you're helping us out. Appreciate it.
All right. Cool.
No
worries.
Well, wonderful. Is it okay to call you John?
Yes, too. Of course, please.
Good. I'm John Costage, and I also have Morgan on the line. He's in Vermont. He's also on my podcast. So.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How did you do?
Not too bad.
Good. Well, it's not a very warm day in Dorset, but the sun is out, which is something. Well, it's been out.
Well, that's nice. The weather here near Pittsburgh, and it's been going up and down. Cold, warm, cold, warm.
Sitting in the middle of planning an expedition to Columbia, so I'm feeling reasonably warm.
Good. I'm going to get the officially started by introducing the segment for the podcast, and then we'll get right to talking to you. Welcome back to the Center Steer podcast. We have a special guest this month. It is Colonel John Blashford Snell of the... What are you of, John? Welcome to the show. you've done a lot of things, and I appreciate you joining us on the show. I met you at Overland Expo East and heard your talk on the Darien Gap transit.
Yeah. Good. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. You tend to fade in and out a little bit, but as long as you can hear me, it's all right.
Exactly. So welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us again. So I heard you do the talk on the Darien Gap Transit, and I guess that's where we'd like to start, if we could. Of course, we're a Land Rover podcast. We talk all about Land Rovers, and that's the things we'd like to touch on. Can you give us a little background on the Darien Gap Transit, and also how did the Land Rovers do, and did you enjoy working with them?
Well, the expedition was launched thanks to the initiative of a committee in Bogota called the Committee Action Pro Darien. And they were had representatives of various Latin American countries who wanted the Pan American Highway completed. And as you may know, a number of expeditions had tried without success, and if anything, this had counted against the chances of the U.S. government coming up with the money to complete the road. At that time, we're talking about 1970s, the Pan American Highway ran down the Alcan Highway from Alaska right down through Central America with varying degrees of construction, but it was more or less complete. And it stopped just outside Panama City. It then restarted once it got into Colombia. But there was this gap of 250 miles of jungle, swamp, mountains, bandits, snakes, all the horrors you can imagine. And there was no way through it at the moment for vehicles or anybody. So this committee were trying to put pressure on the U.S. government to complete the road, which was, in terms of cost, was going to be quite a few million, or probably $1 billion. In the end, they couldn't find anyone to do it, so they came over to England, and they had a meeting with an Anglo-Hispanic organization called Canning House in London, and they laid down a challenge and said, more or less, you know, you Brits are mad enough, why don't you have a go at trying to find a pilot track through this jungle and take vehicles through it to show that it could be done. And, well, I wasn't involved with the first meeting, but subsequently the Army got involved, and because I was a Royal Engineer, my boss was the Chief Royal Engineer, he said, well, I think it's something you should do. And I'd never been to Latin America. I didn't know a great deal about jungle. I knew a lot about desert and bush, but jungle was new to me. But I had done some quite large expeditions in Africa. Well, I sent out a reconnaissance party to have a look at it, which consisted of a mad Irishman who wanted to get out of England at the time, because he had just overtaken a police car in the middle of London doing about 80 miles an hour on the wrong side of the road when he was really drunk. And so he was waiting to go to court, and he thought he ought to get out of the country for a bit. So I gave him £100 and told him to walk through the Darien Gap and come back with a report to me. And that was what he did. He hired a couple of Indians, set out into the jungle. He kept pestering the life out of me, saying he wanted a gun. And I said, you're not having a gun, you'll go and shoot somebody with it. But he did get a gun from somewhere. And off he went with this pistol and these two Indians, and they marched and marched and marched and got quite a few diseases and everything else. But finally they came out of the Darien Gap in Colombia at a very small village. And he was rather surprised to find that there was nobody about. In fact, he looked completely empty. And the two Indians who were with him disappeared as fast as they could. And he thought, well, where the devil are they going? So he was left alone in the middle of the village street with only him and a dog. And the dog came wandering up towards him. When the dog was about 10 feet away, he realized it was frothing at the mouth. And it clearly had rabies. Hence, there was no one there. And his pistol, which was a Smith and Wesson revolver, was somewhere in the bottom of his pack. And the ammunition was wrapped up in his socks. So he quickly dropped his pack and did the fastest unpack you can imagine to find the pistol, find the ammunition, load the gun. And while the dog was closing with him, he managed to shoot it. Immediately, of course, the entire village came to life. Everyone poured out of their houses and carried him on their shoulders for saving them, and he was welcomed as a hero. Well, he'd got through the Darien Gap on foot. He came back to England looking pretty sick and came to see me and said, I think you can do it, but don't ask me to come with you. He didn't, but he did produce this report, which was extremely useful to me. I also had a lot of support by then from the United States forces who were based in what was then the U.S. Canal Zone around the Panama Canal. And they'd done some exercises on the edge of the Darien Gap in preparing vehicles for Vietnam. So they knew quite a bit about it. And there were many alarming stories about how many vehicles they'd lost and how they got stuck in the swamps and so on. But nevertheless, they were quite happy to help us where they could. The Panamanian Guardia Nacional, as they were known, who were a bit like the Tonto Macoute, also offered help. And in Colombia, the Colombian army offered help. Now, the problem was that the Panamanians didn't like the Colombians didn't like the Panamanians, neither of them liked the Americans, and they didn't understand much about the British. So we had to be a sort of liaison party between these differing factions who all wanted to help in their own way as long as they didn't have to work together. And based on that, we then went out to try and find a vehicle that would be suitable. Well, obviously, my mind turned to a Land Rover. But at that point, Rovers had produced this brand new super vehicle, the Range Rover. And they said, this is just the thing we want to show off our new vehicle to the world. And so they talked me into taking two of them. And we appointed a team of army drivers to drive them on the main road bits of the area from Alaska to Panama, and then from through the gap and then down to Terra del Fuego. We had these chaps trained by Rovers, and then I formed a team of about 60 army engineers from Britain, and also, of course, various scientists and specialists, because if you're putting a road through a piece of virgin territory, one has to give thought to what's going to happen to the indigenous people there and the wildlife. So we took with us scientists, biologists, geologists, botanists, and anthropologists to produce a report to say how the indigenous people and the environment should be protected once the road went through. Finally, all was set with the army backing, and we flew the Range Rovers to Alaska inside a Hercules, a C-130, and they started off coming down the Alcan Highway. They had a bit of a prang at one point where they slid off the ice, but they weren't badly damaged. And finally, in January 1972, they reached Panama City. There's only a problem here because instead of being nice and dry, as it should have been for the dry season, it was pouring with rain. And we all arrived from Britain with the engineers and the specialists to actually get them through this 250 miles of the gap. The vehicles were in good order, though, and when the rain slowed down a bit, it didn't completely stop, we set off into the gap. Now, to carry our supplies, we bought 25 horses. These were Pampas ponies, really. We had a vet from the Royal Army Veterinary Corps, two lovely girls who knew about horses, and they were carrying rations and, of course, the petrol for the cars. The Army also sent a Canadian Beaver aircraft with us, with a crew and a lot of parachutes, and they could parachute fresh supplies of everything, fuel, water, beer, into us in the Darien Gap. The Americans said that they would help us with the odd helicopter occasionally, as did the Panamanians. So our logistic support sounded all right. But the first thing to go wrong was we obviously had the wrong sort of tires. And the tires gripped all right in the mud, but the engine was so powerful it couldn't sort of get the drive through to the tires through the differential. And eventually something had to go, and so the differential started to explode. And they went off like a bomb with the teeth coming through the bottoms of the floor into the cargo compartment at the back. Luckily, no one was sitting behind. In fact, there was only one person sitting in the cars at any time, and that was the driver. And it was very slow progress. And to get over the creeks and the bridges and the rivers, we had our engineers hard at work, and they were pushing on ahead using a device called a hillbilly, which was rather like a motorized tracked wheelbarrow. But the problem with that was that it got clogged up with mud. The mud set like cement, and we had to abandon those in the jungle. So by this time, our engineers were reduced to carrying all their tools on the horses. And we were getting short of horses as they began to go down with disease. And finally, after 9 differentials had broken, the Range Rovers came to a halt. We were now about a third of the way into the gap. And, of course, people were beginning to say, there you are, we told you this was never going to work. It was a whole waste of money and so on. And I could see that I wasn't going to be given a very good reception when I got back to England. Anyway, we were very fortunate because a friend of mine, who was my second in command, managed to find a battered old Land Rover in Panama City. And he bought this for a couple of $100s and stripped off everything from it that he possibly could, the doors, the backs and so on. So it was a very light, basic vehicle. And this became the tool carrier. And he brought it in the with a big helicopter we used to call the Jolly Green Giant. It was a U.S. Air Force helicopter. And they dropped this in to the gap. And we pushed on ahead with the engineers, cutting the way through the trail and generally making bridges where we could and preparing the way so that when the Range Rovers got moving, then, of course, they would shoot down this road at a great speed. And we just lived in hope that the Rover Company would find a way of making better differentials, which they did. And these were sent out with an engineer, and they were dropped in by parachute and helicopter and fitted into the vehicles. But meanwhile, the Pathfinder, the Land Rover, was pressing on ahead. To get the cars across the rivers, we had an inflatable raft made by the Avon Company, which could fold up and go in the back of the Range Rovers. And when we got to a river, we inflated it and put the cars on it and then floated it across. One or two of the rivers were shallow enough to wade through. We also had aluminium ladders made of a special lightweight alloy, which could be used to climb up banks and so on and make bridges. And we cut down trees to make bridges as well. And so we pressed on. And once the vehicles got moving, they really did move quite quickly. But they were stopped for several weeks. And so we were rather frightened that the rains were going to come at any time and we were going to be cut off. We would end up like all the previous expeditions. Well, meanwhile, of course, all the scientists were having a field day because they were catching snakes and bugs and beetles and looking at flowers and talking to the Indians and doing all the work that they'd come to. They were in a sort of demi-paradise, so they weren't worried about this. And we pressed forward, and finally we got stopped just near the Colombian border, where there just seemed to be no way through. We came upon the wreckage of some of the previous cars of other expeditions. The General Motors people had tried dragging a sedan car through with a tractor, and we found both the tractor and the car, what was left of it, in the jungle. And it was there that I had a stroke of luck, because I met an old Indian who was a bootlegger, and he knew the area pretty well, and he said to me, you know, if you could work your cars up this riverbed, there's a place we call Cruzamuna, which is where the monkeys jump across. And there's a very steep cliff there, but if you can winch your cars up that cliff, and we had turf or jacks to do this, then I think you could find there's a game trail at the top. You might be able to drive along that and down into Colombia. And that was what we did. And it was thanks to this chap pointing out this trail, which wasn't, of course, marked on any map. And we had a hell of a job getting up there. We almost lost one of the Range Rovers in a river when we were wading through and it sank down into a hole. We managed to pull it out when the water had gone right through one window and out to the other. And you can imagine what that did to the electronics. But we had some very good mechanics with us. And in 36 hours, they got it dried out and working again, which was pretty amazing. So anyway, we ended up on the border with Colombia, where by this time the Panamanians said, right, we can't come any further. It's up to you and the Colombians now. And we met the Colombians on the border, and they were pretty amazing because suddenly 30 very heavily armed Colombian soldiers stepped out of the jungle in camouflage uniforms, and in front of them was an officer and a sergeant major with a scroll. And he unwrapped this scroll and read from it. And he said, you are welcome to our country in memory of the liberators who came to assist Simon Bolivar in 1819. And, of course, one remembered a little bit of history, how British mercenaries went out there to fight the Spanish royalists, and that led, of course, to the freedom of South America and the independence. And the famous battle at a place called Boyacá in Colombia is where the whole tide turned. And the Colombians have never forgotten this. So we were then told that we could march into Colombia with flags flying, bayonets fixed, and drums playing. Well, we hadn't got a drum, but I had a biscuit tin, and we had a shotgun, and we had a flag. And so we marched now into Colombia, escorted by these heavily armed Colombian soldiers. And to strengthen our numbers, I managed to hire about 20 murderers and smugglers from the local prison. They were largely Colombians who might have smuggled into Panama. And for a case of whiskey, I got all these chaps released by the Panamanian jailers on condition that I took them to Colombia and they didn't come back. And they were a particularly tough bunch. And one wondered what would happen when we got them in the jungle. But I said to them, if one of you tries anything funny, I've got with me a Gurkha. And we had this Gurkha, who, of course, as you may know, is a man of Nepal, a very fine soldier, who always go around with a curved knife called a kukri. And he really looked the part. And I said to these chaps, if you run away or do anything or steal anything, this man will kill you. I think they believed it, but they stayed with us and they helped us to cut the pilot track on from there. And we then dropped down into this enormous swamp, which was sort of several hundred miles long. And there was no way you could drive over it. And it was very difficult to get any sort of boat to go through it because it was covered in water hyacinths. And the Colombian Navy has sent a gunboat along to help on the crossing, and that stood by and gave us support. But what we did was to get our raft up, and then we tried to push our way through the water hyacinth. But it was so thick we couldn't get through, so we had to make necklaces out of detonating cord with lumps of plastic explosives, and we threw this ahead like a sort of lasso in front of the boat. It landed on the water up to 20 yards out. We then lit the fuse and backed off, and this went off with a bang, and it broke up the water hyacinths long enough for us to get the raft through, and then we did the next stretch. So it was like getting through ice, really, but it was plant. And finally, after several days, we did reach a point on the banks of a creek where we were able to get onto the edge of the creek where it was dry enough and just wide enough to take the Range Rovers. And by this time, we had very little time left before the rain started. And so we were pushing and pushing and pushing. And some half of our men, 50%, had gone down with various diseases and illnesses, and particularly immersion foot, when literally the flesh was falling off their feet. And we managed to get out at a place called Chigorodó, onto the end of the Pan-American Highway on St. George's Day, which is the patron saint of England, was rather appropriate. And we came to an enormous welcome by the Colombians. And we went into the local town. We were made freemen of the town. And there was a huge party with all the beer and girls you could wish for. And that night, the rains came, and it came down in a deluge. And if we'd been any longer, we would still be in that swamp today. And from here, we were welcomed up into the Andes, to Medellin, and then to a big parade in Bogota, where we laid a wreath on the statue of Simon Bolivar in memory of the Colombians who died trying to help us, because the Colombian army and their marines had lost a number of people coming to assist us. One lot were ambushed by the FARC terrorists, and the other lot, five of them, were drowned when a boat turned over. So they had really suffered quite considerably. All we'd had was sickness, but no one was actually killed. And from Bogota, the Range Rovers then set out and drove the rest of the journey down to Terra del Fuego. And it took, I think it was 17,007 miles in all, and the whole thing took about 6 months. But the results came out of it, and the reports, of course, did to some extent protect the people who lived in the zone. A huge national park was established in the border area, which is still there, but, of course, the road was never completed. They took it as far as a place called Yavisa, and at that point, the dictator of Panama at the time, Omar Torrijos, said, I would rather have a road along my frontier than across it, because he didn't want foot and mouth and drugs and things coming in that way. So to this day, there is still the last 60 miles, and there are various expeditions going off at the moment, some on foot, one lot on motorcycles from the British Army, trying to get through. The problem now, though, is in addition to all the snakes and creepy crawlies, it's the terrorist movement, particularly the ELN operating on the Panama side. So it's still a very dodgy area to try and cross. That's it in a nutshell.
That's fantastic. So the question is that, you know, that you said 60 miles isn't completed for those reasons also, isn't it, because that area is unspoiled? And do you think it should be left that way? Because isn't it basically a swamp in that area?
Sorry?
The unfinished area, isn't it a swamp?
Well, a lot of it is the swamp.
Yeah, should that be
the Atrato swamp? And then there's a range of hills on the border between Panama and Colombia. The last place you can get to on any sort of road is called Yavisa. And one of my friends has just been on an expedition on foot, and he walked up as far as Yavisa, but the Panamanian Frontier Force, as they call it now, wouldn't allow him to go on the route that we went because of the security problem with the terrorists. You're saying something about the environment.
Yes. Should that area still have a road created, since it is an important environmental area, being a large swamp?
It's questionable. I mean, quite frankly, the crossing of the swamp is an enormous engineering problem, and I wonder really whether it's worth it. As a conservationist myself, I think I'd rather see it preserved. But because there is this big national park on the border with Colombia, which extends both into Colombia and Panama. And I think if you can get rid of the terrorists, then there'd be a good chance that the wildlife and the fauna and flora would survive.
You do kind of moving on from the Darien Gap expedition. You've done other expeditions and have continued to do those in your life. What are some of the ones in the last several decades that you've done that may involve Land Rovers? Any interesting additional stories?
Well, I've used Land Rovers a lot, of course, in the desert, particularly in the Sahara, with the Army, which we had Land Rovers as a standard vehicle. And I've also used them in other expeditions in South America and Nepal and all over the world. It's an amazing vehicle. And the great thing with the Land Rover was it was so simple. You could, you could virtually do everything on it yourself. The Range Rover was a bit of a challenge because it was like all these modern vehicles. It was highly electronic. And I was driving one of the very latest models last year in Britain. That was the Rover company took me out for a day on their test track. And I just wonder how they would get on in these conditions of extreme humidity and heat and rough going. I'm sure they stand up with a rough going, but I think with electronics, the problem often is the humidity.
Good point. I hadn't considered the humidity, but they do testing. But interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Well, certainly the old Land Rover we had, the Pathfinder, was we used to laugh and say it was tied together with a piece of string. It was a very, very simple vehicle, and you could fix everything yourself. You know, it was just a very basic machine.
Yeah. What happened to that vehicle?
And it was light. It was light enough because we'd taken all the bits off it. It was light enough for about six or seven guys to lift it.
Yeah, they are very versatile and very easy to work on. Whatever happened to that vehicle?
Well, the Land Rover, when we flew it back from Bogota in a Colombian Air Force plane to Panama City, and we had a parade with the Colombian Guardia Nacional to say thank you to them. And afterwards, we decided that we would present it as a gift to the colonel of the Guardia. And he immediately thanked us, jumped in, and drove it off. But he drove off before I had time to explain to him that the brakes didn't work. And he crashed straight into a wall, didn't hurt himself, but that was the end of the vehicle, I think. But the Range Rovers went on to Terra del Fuego, and they came back to England. And, of course, they're now in the historic vehicle museum, and they're still running. They come out on exhibitions occasionally. In fact, for 1 year, I drove one all around England exhibiting it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's very cool.
This story is that you just told, by the way, is all in your book, Something Lost Behind the Ranges, and I recommend people go out and check out the book.
Something Lost Behind the Ranges,
yes.
Beyond the Ranges, yes.
It's a great read, by the way.
The story is in that. There were a number of books written about it. One was called The 100 Days of Darien, which was a complete book on the whole story. My book, it's got several chapters on it, and there were two movie films made of it, one in Britain, one in Canada, there are still people. I go around the place giving talks about this expedition and doing PowerPoint presentations. There's still an enormous interest in the crossing of the Darien Gap, and recently this British adventurer has just been walking through, and I saw him the other day, and from what he told me, it hasn't changed much. But, of course, he could get to Yaviza by road, but it's the last 60 miles or so that is still a complete blockage.
It's amazing that that is still the case after all these years.
Well, I think it's the cost of crossing that swamp, you know, and unless you're going to invest a lot of money in it, it's probably just as easy to cut across and come in by sea on the coast. But one problem they've got at the moment is illegal immigration. I'm told that up to 20,000 illegal immigrants are coming into Central America through the Darien Gap every year. And the drug smugglers have now become people smugglers.
Yeah, I know there's a large number of folks coming up from South America and North America from that direction. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Trump's wall may be quite useful in stopping them.
exactly. So you've also created your own organization to do expeditions. Is that correct?
Well, the Scientific Exploration Society was going at the start when we were on the Darien Gap. It was under the auspices of the society, although it was heavily backed by the army and the forces of the different countries. And we do expeditions all over the world, and we take volunteers who are prepared to come with us and pay their share of the costs. And I'm off to Colombia in May to deliver an ambulance boat to a tribe in a remote corner of Colombian Amazonas coming off the Amazon. And this boat is being built at the moment on the Amazon. And then we shall take it up river and deliver it to these Indians, because it's the only way they've got of getting to a hospital. And there are no roads or helicopter strips or anything in that area.
Wow. Yeah, that's really amazing. If you check out your website, you can get all the information on your expeditions, the upcoming ones. And you're also going to, after that, in Kenya in 2018. Is that right?
Well, Kenya, again, most of the work we do now is really to help the people in the hope that they will look after the fauna and the flora and the environment. And so we take in medical and dental aid. And whether we're looking for lost cities or lost animals or rare plants or whatever, by helping the people, we get them on the side. And so doctors, and particularly dentists, are always very valuable on these expeditions. And in this one coming off in May, I've got three doctors and two dentists, and also I've got engineers and biologists and so on. So the great thing is we're contributing something for the people.
Absolutely. It's very admirable.
Very admirable.
I noticed.
And we get a number of our friends in America who come. Bob Atwater, who's an American adventurer, who's a leading member of the Explorers Club, he's completely hooked on it, and he comes on most of the expeditions with us. He's done some exciting Land Rover trips, too.
Oh, really? To track him down.
Now, I'm curious about something you mentioned during the Darien Gap, that you had the collapsible rafts.
Yes.
Now, are those similar to or precursors to the models that were used in the Camel Trophy?
Probably was, because the guy who was running the Camel Trophy was my adjutant. So he got the ideas very much from us, I think. But this particular raft was two big hulls with these aluminium ladders on top as decking.
Very fascinating. And let's see, I've got one other question here. Now, I believe before you did the Darien Gap and that portion of Alaska to Cape Horn, did you do a trip down the Nile?
Yes, we managed to navigate the Blue Nile, which was had not been navigated completely before. That was in Ethiopia in 1968, and that was an interesting journey. It was about 500 miles of rapids and hippos and crocodiles and a lot of bandits. In fact, we had to fight our way out with two gangs of bandits who outnumbered us quite considerably. But luckily, we were armed in those days, and we managed to fight our way out of there. But we also, to get through these rapids, we developed using inflatable boats, and this started off the idea of whitewater rafting, which, of course, the Avon company who made the boats for us suddenly realized that they'd got a winner. So they started producing whitewater boats. Up to that point, we were just using boats that were used as tenders for rafts.
Wow.
And it was a very exciting expedition. And we went back in 2005 and did another part of the area, which was another river that came into the Blue Nile and down there. Once again, we ran into trouble with the bandits, and this time we were taken prisoner because the local authorities didn't want us carrying guns. Had we had guns, we could have fought our way out again. But this time they said, no guns, we're a peaceful country. And so they then had to send a relief force to attack the bandits and get us out, which they did very efficiently.
It sounds like you've been very fortunate in getting through all of your expeditions.
Well, the good Lord has been kind to me, I think. I hope he'll continue to do so for a few years yet.
It certainly seems like it. You look at your resume and your biography, it's just amazing the things you've done, the number of them, and it's wonderful. And of course, you seem to dedicate yourself to exploration and helping other human beings, so I think is also admirable.
We have a very good team of people, and a lot of the people who come with us have been previously, so we get to know each other pretty well. We always get new people, but I must say, the most of the people are British or American or Canadian or English-speaking. But we do get, of course, in South America, we get South Americans taking part. And in places like Asia, we've just done an expedition in Mongolia using horses and camels. And we had a lot of Mongolians on that. And we were doing wildlife studies, archaeology, and also pulling out all the local people's teeth. That's the one thing they wanted. They wanted dentists.
Seems.
We try to convert the people to be conservationists. One of our one of our favorite tricks is that when a child comes along to have a tooth removed, after that we give them a teddy bear or a teddy puppet of an animal, and we say, this is yours now. You've got to try to convert your parents not to kill the animals. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the kids have got used to this now, and they tend to come up to us now and point at their tooth and say, take out my tooth. I want an animal.
That doesn't seem, it seems like they should be taking, you should give them puppets of their teeth so they can take care of their teeth instead.
Yeah, well, we've got, I'm right behind where I'm sitting now. There's a huge case of teddy bears that were made by local ladies recently. And these will be going out to Colombia in a few months' time. We
very
also
nice.
Distribute spectacles, because particularly the indigenous people whose sight is beginning to go, and they can't see as well as they could to make handicrafts, they are very grateful for a pair of reading glasses. So we take out used reading glasses with us and give those out.
So on a personal level, what's your favorite vehicle? What do you have a current daily driver? Do you enjoy driving?
Oh, I think without it's cross country, I would say a Land Rover and a Range Rover. But I mean, the Land Rover is the simple Land Rover. The Discovery, unfortunately, is not being made anymore. I've just been working with a guy in England called Ben Fogel, who's just written the history of the Land Rover.
Yes.
It's a shame. Well, there are a lot of them around. For some reason, they've stopped making the Discovery version. They're still making Range Rovers, of course. Perhaps they'll start reproducing them again. But I think the great thing is, if you're on an expedition, you want something that's easy to maintain. And, the old Willys Jeep in World War II, look how simple that was.
They still make those. They're still big here in the U.S., the commercial version.
Well, they stopped making the Discovery Land Rover, which was the sort of the main one,
right.
Only this year or in the last year. But the Range Rovers are still made. Of course, there's some of them very luxurious vehicles now. I mean, I went to speak at a conference in Norway a couple of years ago, and there are people paying, $400,000 for the upmarket Range Rover.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that's out of my price range.
Yeah. I would, and there's some people in England, a lady who does a lot of fundraising, well, she's got one. I know she just paid $110,000 for that. That's pounds.
Yeah.
So they're not cheap, but they are superbly luxury vehicles. And on normal going, they're very, very good. And I think for a lot of expeditions these days, providing you know what you're doing and you can get some sort of electronic support, they are excellent. But if I were to go back into the Darien Gap, I'd want a really very, very simple vehicle.
Yeah, back to your Pathfinder vehicle. Figure your time's coming to a close, John. Is there anything else before we wrap this up, direction to go?
No, that's fine. I'm not sure when I'm coming over to the States again, but I'm always interested in very prepared to come over and lecture the people about it and about, well, not only the crossing of the Darien Gap, but the various expeditions that we do. And you know how to get put people on to me if there's anyone interested.
Absolutely. I have a link in the show notes to your website and also and to information about
you. They can get in touch with us. And I remember the Explorers Club, which is based in New York, and I was lecturing there the other day. So I do come back and forth occasionally.
Yeah. As I said, I saw you in October.
Yes, that's right. That was
cool.
Very pleasant visit, and we just missed the hurricane, too.
That's right. That's correct, yeah. Well, just like in the Darien Gap when you missed the big rainstorm.
Yeah.
Your presentation was excellent. The PowerPoint, you had a lot of pictures, which is great. And also, I highly recommend the book. It's a good read. I haven't gotten all the way through it yet, I admit. But it's really good read. So, John, thank you for...
If people want the book, they can get those. It tells you on our website where to get hold of us. And
correct.
We hold the books here in the society.
Oh, okay. Good deal, yeah. Well, I was lucky I got mine at the Overland Expo, and you signed it, so fantastic.
Well, very nice to talk with you. I wish you every success with your program.
Well, thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. We're just a small little Land Rover-focused podcast. We do this once a month, and I really appreciate you coming on the show. This is a great honor for us.
Yes. And just hang on one moment.
Come in.
Sorry, go on. Sorry, it was just someone knocking at the door.
No worries. I was just thank you for coming on the show, and it was a great honor to have you on the show. And all the things you've done in your life is great to hear about the stories.
Well, thank you very much. Well, very nice to speak to you, and good luck to all our friends in America.
Thank you, sir. Take care. Have a good day.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
That's the Sinister Year podcast for February 2017, show number 47. I want to thank our guest this month, John Blashford Snell, for the interview. We called him via Skype back in the middle of the month. That was a fantastic interview, great stories, and I recommend you go out and get his book. It's a really good read. He is a really good writer, too, and it's some interesting stories all the way back to his childhood when he was living on the Isle of Jersey, which you may recall we had an interview with another resident of the Isle of Jersey a few months ago. And also, thanks to the One True Pax for his production support. That's one of the reasons why the show sounds so good. At least I think it sounds much better than it used to. And also, thanks to Morgan, our contributor from Vermont.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure as always.
And how is seriesparts.com?
It's still going.
I
need to get back and do some improvements to it as, you know, technologies change and improve. So that'll be happening hopefully fairly soon here.
Want to give you a shout out for seriesparts.com.
Thank you very much.
For all your series parts and needs, right?
Exactly.
Don't you have your short little 10-second elevator speech?
Yes, I do. Basically, it helps you find vehicles, parts, or garages to service your series Land Rover.
In North America.
Actually, worldwide.
Ooh, now worldwide.
Big time you are.
He's gone worldwide. And also thanks to Harold, who doesn't live too far from me. Hi, thanks, Harold, for joining the show.
Yeah, well, 10 bucks is 10 bucks.
Who are you getting 10 bucks from?
Hey, that's what it costs me to show up for you, dude.
Even in the mini?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's worth it. It's good having
gas,
you.
Gas, oil, time, aggravation. Yeah, 10 bucks is 10 bucks.
It's good having you in the studio.
All right. Well, one of these days I'll have time, but for now I'm too busy doing things that are important.
Exactly. For me, which is very important. Yes.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I thought you might think so. Mm-hmm.
Indeed, I do. Indeed, I do. So that is the podcast for this month. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening. Reminder to visit our website for past shows and show notes. You can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter to give us your feedback on the news, topics, and other such things that we discussed this month. You can also directly support the show at www.patreon.com/centersteer. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And thanks to our new Patreon contributor, whose name I'm trying to find as I talk, Stephen Williams. Thanks again to Stephen for being our new Patreon supporter. I also had a nice little Twitter exchange with some folks, and which gave me the idea for the Defender Roundtable discussion. So if you have ideas, if you think we should do that, or what kind of form it should take. I think it'll be I imagine it being a separate show from the rest of the show, and we'd maybe get some different people to talk about things. If you were maybe want to be interested or you have an idea for how that should work, send me a tweet, send me an email, get us on Facebook. And also, thanks to Aaron Scott, he posted on our Facebook page a link to Harry's Garage review of the Range Rover Classic, which I thought was pretty cool. So thanks for that, Aaron. As I said, we'd love to hear from you and what you're up to with your Land Rover. But until next time, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover fan. Thanks for listening, and wave as we pass by.
Deedle deed 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 deed, something like that.